verse and put me back an hour. Try it. Get yourself a good TSB set that you can reverse. Because you should have the previous hour. You can take it. The Ethiopian version is more explicit than the biblical, where the Bible only hints at a sexual liaison. Ethiopian chronicles describe a seduction in detail. The queen left Solomon immediately afterward. Continues this legend, and 9 months later gave birth to a son named Menelik. I've done all I'm going to do with that tonight. As a grown man, Menelik visited his father in Jerusalem before returning to found a dynasty which ruled intermittently until the overthrow of Emperor Haile Selassie in 1974. The Ethiopians were converted to Christianity, legend and historians agree, by Syrian missionaries in the 4th century A.D. Falasha traditions depart from that national one when the Israelites arrive in Ethiopia. The Falashas believe the same thing, but that's the way they got there. But they depart from the national Christian story, as Bruce's account describes. Quote, being very industrious, these people multiplied exceedingly. They had this divine imperative. Talked about that before. And were very powerful at the time of the conversion to Christianity, or as they term it, the apostasy. The Falashas view the conversion of Ethiopia to Christianity as the great apostasy. At that time, they declared a prince of the tribe of Judah and of the race of Solomon and Menelik their sovereign. The name of this prince was Phinehas, who refused to abandon the religion of his forefathers. Now, Bruce was skeptical about this Falasha tale. He says his restrained appraisal was that many difficulties occur in this account of the Falasha. Few since Bruce have taken it any more seriously than he did, which is not to say their alternatives have been more reasonable. Now, I'm on this because in the news the last couple of nights, the Falashas have been brought to the forefront in an airlift called Exodus in some of the news stories. And turn the light down. I don't want to have to see my audience. They're too overstimulated tonight. Particularly the Fockett brothers. In the news, we've heard Danites returning. That has a basis in the opinion of the rabbi in Jerusalem. Others trace them in their origin simply to Queen of Sheba and Solomon, which would make them of the line of Judah through pharaohs. Danites or Jews? That's the question. The origin of the Falashas has inspired more nonsense than James Bruce ever dreamed of. Even today, when the speculation has turned from the imaginative to the scientific, it is difficult to find any two opinions which agree. The mystery of Falasha origins is not much closer to being solved today than it was in Bruce's time. Ruling out some of the more fanciful theories is the easiest thing to do. It is not very likely that Falashas are descendants of Moses' followers who turned right out of Egypt instead of left, ending up in Ethiopia instead of Palestine. Check one off. This writer says, nor is it likely that they are descendants of the lost tribe of Dan, as Israel's chief rabbis claim, and that, by the way, has become the basis of their acceptance, why they now can be airlifted in, reminiscent of the way they brought the Jews out of Yemen a few years ago. Once again, we see the prophecy out of Isaiah being fulfilled. Who are these that fly as doves to the window? This may be the one he had in mind in that prophecy, because I'm sure it would have been somewhat of a shock to Isaiah, or to Ezekiel, or to Daniel, to see black Jews flying in. Not only the mode of transportation, but their appearance would be inspiring the question to them, those ancient prophets, who are these that fly as a bird to the window? I love to see the Bible fulfilled. Nor is it likely that they are descendants of Jewish soldiers posted in Upper Egypt with the Persian emperors. President Ben-Zvi believed that was their source. Or refugees from the destruction of one Jerusalem temple or the other. This fellow says it's not very likely the Flossians are descendants of Jews at all. Who's he to say? How often have we seen these legends based in fact? As an undergraduate major in history, I've come to respect the word of mouth, oral tradition, and the devotion to accuracy, such as the great bards of Ireland. I've come to respect their record, even with embellishments. The germs of truth remain constant and consistent, as much as I do modern historians, more accurately described as his story. Not in the spiritual sense of being Christ's story, but in the sense that it's the historian's story, his story. Most modern historians write with a purpose. They're trying to prove a point. These ancient oral traditions were a sacred possession, passed on from generation to generation. Who's this guy say? The most consistent story is the one that has always been the national myth of Ethiopia. Descendants of the union between the Queen of Sheba and Solomon produce that identity with Old Testament literature and the Hebrew nation that marked both the Flossians and the Christians of Ethiopia. Why then the relatively modern version? They're Danites. Well, I've already told you in the source, Eldad the Danite, but has been given the authority of pronouncements from Jerusalem. It doesn't really matter whether the Danites or descendants of Judahites. They are practicing Jews in their religion. Where did this Judaism come from? Well, not all historians agree. All we really know for sure until the arrival of the Europeans is what we're told by Ethiopian chronicles. Sounds like the Milesian Chronicles of Spain, the Irish Chronicles, the English Chronicles. Oh, well, that has to be fiction, because we superior Europeans who couldn't even see a star that the Dogon tribe was worshiping can't accept anything as history outside of our critical view of it. Well, Homer proved true under the spade of Schliemann. And methinks as history approaches its end, God's control over the destinies of the world. And back in Deuteronomy, he said, he marked out the boundaries of the nations with the descendants of these children of faith that he had in view as his oracle people, with their descendants in mind. How could a great wilderness like America be so sparsely populated? Because God said to David, after he had ruled and occupied the nation, both Israel and Judah, the son of Saul ruled for several years before David unified the kingdom and moved the capital of Judah from ancient Hebron to Jerusalem. And his kingdom extended from the Euphrates River to Egypt, the Nile River. And they were at peace. And God says through Nathan to David, he's going to establish a dynasty through his son. But he says he's going to give his people Israel a place. God marked the boundaries out for these people and all the nations and peoples of the earth are given limits and boundaries because of the plan God has for his chosen people. Why is it? They have a sort of common physical heritage. Why is it that they were so good at producing lots of their kind in China, in Japan, Malaysia? They didn't have any trouble producing quantity there. And this vast North American continent, so sparsely populated. I mean, the explorers would have had one whale of a time if, as was originally thought when Columbus set out to make his mark, that he had landed in India. Been a little harder to go west, young man, if that had been where they landed. Lots more bodies to move aside. Now, that may not be very comforting to the American Indian. And I'm part Indian. I sympathize with the Indian's plight. But I'm telling you, God set the boundaries of all peoples. In the book of Deuteronomy, he says he did it with his people in mind. These chosen ones. All we know for sure until the arrival of the Europeans is what we're told by the Ethiopian Chronicles. Why does that make it fictitious? These do not mention Falashas until the 14th century. And even then only when describing wars waged against them by Ethiopian kings. They pick up Falashia history while they're still independent and trace their gradual subjugation through a series of wars, treaties, broken alliances, and forced baptisms. Falashia independence came to its final end 300 years later in 1632, a last-ditch rebellion suppressed by a massacre of Falashia men, women, and children. They were dispersed from their homeland, forbidden to own land, encouraged to convert to Christianity, and generally reduced to penury. Without their own land, they turned more and more to handicrafts for a livelihood. They've been on the bottom rung of Ethiopia's social ladder ever since. Ethiopian chronicles do not mention them again, but by this time the first Europeans were on the scene. They have all the traits. And even though it inspires sympathy, they have all the traits of what happened to the scattered, dispersed Jews prophesied. The two sisters, the two wives, Israel and Judah. One is divorced, Israel. The other is dispersed, and punished until the time allotted, the seven times, is run. And then they will be found and gathered and brought back to their homeland. But the scattered tribes of Israel will have a place that when they arrive there prepared, they won't move again. They'll become a mighty force, a commonwealth of nations, a mighty nation, possessing the gates of their enemies, pushing the peoples to the ends of the earth, a people as numerous as the sand of the sea and as the stars of the heavens, and in the place that they have been known as not my people, they'll become known as the sons of God. If I had to choose, by inductive reasoning alone, these Philoshes have the traits of the wife that was dispersed and punished, not the traits of the divorced wife that becomes a mighty nation. And as the dispersed wife that was punished, wandering without a home, this one, Judah, must be brought again to Jerusalem, again to establish a nation, again to build a temple. You see, the book of Daniel allots 70 weeks of years. And as the prophet Daniel receives his message from the angel, seventy weeks of years is what that means, are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. There is no greater mistake made by prophecy people than failing to realize that God pinpoints his message with precision with the words that he uses, and don't take it out of his meets and boundaries. When God interprets the revelation of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had through the mouth of Daniel, he's not discussing world history. He's discussing the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar and the kingdoms that will grow out of it. He's discussing the insanity of that seven times rule of that kingdom originating in Babylon and ending when God pulls that chain at the end of 2,520 years. It is the kingdom that flows out of Nebuchadnezzar's empire. Babylon to the Persian, Medo-Persian, to the Grecian, to the Roman, to the ten-toed, to Antichrist's kingdom, to the end, when the stone that grows to a great mountain crushes that image, the stone not made with hands. In this passage, likewise, there's precision. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. Nebuchadnezzar's image is not a history of the world. It doesn't say a thing about the Chinese emperors. It has nothing to do with the Aztec and Toltec and Inca empires. Nothing to do with the Zulu empire down in Africa. It's the kingdoms that grow out of Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. Daniel's 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, Judah. And nothing to do with 10 tribes. 10 tribes are already gone when Daniel is spoken to. 10 tribes were carried into bondage in Assyria. Only Judah was carried into bondage in Babylon. Really, for the most part, the area that was around Jerusalem and the remnant left after the Assyrian Empire had conquered most of Israel. They go to Babylon. Daniel is of that group. He's one of the eunuchs. Hezekiah had shown all the treasures of the kingdom to the king of Babylon. Isaiah came and said, "What did you show him?" He said, "Everything. King of Babylon will take everything you showed him, and your princes will be made eunuchs." Daniel was one of them. And he served in the court of Nebuchadnezzar first. His son Belshazzar prophesied his doom when the hand was on the wall. Cyrus and Darius, he went through four kings. And when this vision comes to Daniel, the message is 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. And nothing to do with the church. Doesn't have anything to do with Israel, the 10 tribes. Thy people. The church continually gets confused in its prophetic teachings but trying to make this a prophecy for all the descendants of Israel. Nothing to do with all the descendants of Israel. It has to do with the kingdom of Judah. And only the kingdom of Judah. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression. Alternative is to restrain it. To make an end of sins. The alternative meaning is seal them up. Which they'll do when they cast old Satan into the bottomless pit for 1,000 years. And seal him up. To make reconciliation for iniquity. That is going to encompass what is done by Christ, the greater son of Judah, Messiah, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness. Messiah is that. To seal up the vision and the prophecy, to anoint the most holy. Every one of those things have to be done. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem, and that's the key date, and there is a fight in theology over three different dates. From the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The streets shall be built again, the walls even in troublesome times. After 62 weeks, shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince that shall come shall destroy the city, and the sanctuary and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And I add those up. After 60, what's 60? And 2? 62 weeks, right? And from the going forth of the commandment to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62. So 62 and 7 is 69. Breaks into two increments. What are you counting me for? Who? Dallas? Why in the world are they leaving now? I'm just getting started. 7 weeks to finish the building, then 62 weeks until Messiah's cut off. That's 69. Got 1 week left. And there's a gap in between. And that gap is what's going on now. The parenthesis, while, as Paul says, God welded or grafted on the wild olive branch that he dealt with. And the 70th week is yet to come, 7 more years, when he will return and finish with his attention on Judah. Now, I want to talk to you about that 26th verse, but my Lord, we're leaving Dallas. Whew, I get so tired. Isn't there some way we can put all these stations on at the same time? Whatever the hour. That gap, after 62, I'm just going to keep talking. See you tomorrow night, Dallas. After 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. He's not going to die for anything he did. We the Christians know, for the sins of the whole world. And the people of the Prince that shall come, who's the Prince that shall come? That's Antichrist. Shall destroy the city and and the sanctuary. And the end thereof shall be with the flood. This same prince that shall come, which is Antichrist, shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. He'll make a 7-year covenant with Israel. In the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. What in the world? Are we off air? And he shall confirm. I thought he was off air. What a day. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. In short, that plus a whole slew of other scriptures. I may preach on that Sunday, because I'm about to that point in the book of Revelation. Lord willing, I think I will. You need to be in the King's House Sunday anyway. And I can finish that subject. The relevance to the Colossians is that wife that was dispersed and punished but not divorced, that sister, in the passage of Aholah and Aholibah, one being Samaria and the other being Jerusalem, the Jew, the nation Judah, went to Babylon. As Jeremiah prophesied, at the end of 70 years, they'd return. They built the second temple. They paved the way for the coming of the righteous branch. That's why they were building their own prophets. Haggai and Zechariah motivated them by saying that the temple they were building, the righteous branch, would be there. It was greater than the one Solomon had built because Messiah would be in it. Well, Christians believe that's what happened when Jesus walked into that temple on that great day in the Feast of the Tabernacles and read from Isaiah and stopped in mid-sentence with the same gap as this verse in Daniel, saying this day, this scripture is fulfilled. Had he gone on, he would have jumped over the gap to the day he comes in righteousness as described in Revelation 19 to set up his kingdom, and to that deed that he performs for his people at the close of the 7 years. These Jews, 70 weeks were determined, and the 69th week closed when Messiah was cut off, not for his own doing. Now a gap is in motion, and during that gap, the dispersion and the punishment and the scattering of the Jew is taking place. And in God's time, he pulls the chain. And unlike the 10 tribes who have a place prepared as promised to David through Nathan, these scattered Jews, wherever they may be, including those that descend from Solomon through Queen of Sheba, they're to be brought back. And they'll build the temple again, because the covenant will be made, a covenant of peace, and that third temple has to be built, which will be the one that is desecrated by Antichrist in the Daniel abomination of desolation and the other companion passages that speak of it. These Colossians, in short, in my view, have the characteristics of the non-divorced wife, the persecuted one, that are being brought home, that can make the prophet cry out, "Who are these that fly as a bird to the window?" But ironically, because of the decision of the Jewish rabbis, they are designated as Danites. What's the basis for that theory? Well, am I boring you? Even before James Bruce, the outside world was not entirely ignorant of Colossians. A few Jewish and Arab travelers mentioned them in passing, mostly from hearsay. An occasional Colossian slave turned up in the Arab world. The religious wars of Ethiopia were well known in Egypt by the 1500s. The Portuguese and Spanish began to frequent Ethiopia at that time, too. A few brief missionary and explorer accounts preceded Bruce's, revealing little more than that the Colossians existed. The Colossians had their first contact with a foreign Jew in the 1600s. In one of the most curious and least known episodes of that area, an otherwise unknown Viennese Jew surfaced in the capital of Ethiopia in the early 1600s. His name was either Solomon or Abraham, depending on whose account you believe, and he was dressed as a merchant. He's known to have held a religious disputation with Catholic missionaries. The results are uncertain as his name. According to Portuguese accounts, which call him Solomon, the Jew was out-debated and was expelled from Ethiopia. The Falasha tradition, which calls him Abraham, claims he won and that his victory saved them from massacre. None of these reports attracted much attention in Europe. It was Bruce's detailed narrative published in 1790 which first piqued Western curiosity. A series of scholars and Protestant missionaries contacted Falashas in the 1800s to find out more about them and the missionaries to win their souls. The missionaries were by far the more successful of the two. Forbidden by the king from seeking converts among Ethiopian Christians, because they considered themselves to be Christians and of a superior kind, the missionaries thus spent all their energy on Falashas, with considerable results. Their widely advertised success disturbed European Jews. A prominent German rabbi, Azrael Hildesheimer, published a full-page appeal in the Jewish Chronicle in 1864 calling for a mission to rescue Falashas before they were all converted. It is our duty, he said, to deliver them from the pernicious toils in which they are ensnared by men who have no regard for the bonds of family and religion, he declared. 3 years later, the Alliance Israelite Universelle dispatched a French linguist named Joseph Halevi to report on the situation. Halevi was a 40-year-old teacher and Orientalist born in Adrianople, whose success in this mission would launch a spectacular career in Oriental philology, which lasted another 50 years. After a dangerous and irregular journey, he finally reached a Falasha village. They refused to believe he was Jewish. You're going to like this. You're really going to like this, I think. When this French Jewish linguist, after a dangerous and irregular journey, finally reached a Falasha village, they refused to believe he was Jewish. What? He wrote that they told him, "You, a Falasha? A white Falasha?" They knew they weren't no honky Jews. He won them over by telling them he came from Jerusalem, which he had visited along the way. I assured them that all the Falashas of Jerusalem and in other parts of the world were white, Halevi wrote, and that they could not be distinguished from the other inhabitants of their respective countries. The name of Jerusalem, which I had accidentally mentioned, changed as if by magic the attitude of the most incredulous. A burning curiosity seemed all at once to have seized the whole company. "Oh, do you come from Jerusalem, the blessed city? Have you beheld with your own eyes Mount Zion and the house of the Lord of Israel, the holy temple?" And the Frenchman wrote, "I must confess I was deeply moved on seeing those black faces light up at the memory of our glorious history." Halevi's mission could not have been more well-timed. Only 5 years earlier, a feud between missionaries and Falashas had ended in a disastrous millennial movement. Three Protestant missionaries had debated five Falashas in the presence of the king, attempting to convert them by reinterpreting the Falasha's own scripture in Christian light. They argued over the unity versus trinity of God, over the practice of sacrifice, and over the unwillingness of Falashas to convert. The king's verdict is not known. Again, it depends on whose version you believe. By all accounts, however, Falashas embarked on a mass pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Following the debate, entire villages and parts of others packed their belongings and began walking in that general direction. They knew only that Jerusalem was somewhere beyond the Red Sea, but believed that their exodus would be attended with miracles as had that of their ancestors out of Egypt. Their leader, a Falasha monk, assured them that the Red Sea would part for them as it had for Moses. But it didn't happen. They were forced to stop before even sighting water. Most perished during 3 years of hardship in northeast Ethiopia. Only a few managed to return. Halevi in his travels saw many empty homes abandoned by the pilgrims. He toured Falasha villages, observed their customs, interviewed priests and monks, brought back the first Falasha manuscripts to Europe. He also brought back two young Palacios in person, who insisted on accompanying him to Europe. On his return, he declared unequivocally that Palacios were Jews. His assertion was received with skepticism. Halevi's mission won no immediate support for Palacios. The alliance launched no programs to aid them as it had for other impoverished Jews. It remained for a student of Halevi's, Jacques Petlovich, to become their champion. Not so dispassionate as a teacher, Petlovich was as interested in helping Palacios as in studying them. He lived with them for 18 months in 1904 to 1905 and returned to Europe to plead their cause. He too brought back two young Palacios, the first of several whom he placed in European schools. Petlovich initially won no more support than Halevi had. Still skeptical, the alliance sent another envoy in 1907-8, a prominent Turkish rabbi named Haim Nahum. Rabbi Nahum was considerably less enthusiastic. Quote, "It doesn't seem to me desirable that anything should be done," he told one journalist on his return. "In view of their small numbers and wide distribution, the creation of schools seems to me impossible, and the Alliance Israelite Universelle, they agreed with him. Undaunted by rejection, however, Petlovich formed pro-Palacio committees to raise funds in Italy and Germany. You see, the news doesn't tell us any of this history. Just a big secret that they would have us believe they discovered. On a third visit in 1913-14, he founded a mobile school to tour Palacio villages. He continued fundraising in the United States after World War I, and in 1923 founded a Palacio boarding school in Addis Ababa. I'm telling you, folks, it may take us a few years, but we're going to wake up people to the truth about themselves, too, and God's promises. The school was headed by a young Palacio named Tom Arat Emanuel, whom Petlovich had sent to Europe and America for education, and who later became a minister in Haile Selassie's government before dying in Israel in 1963. Petlovich's efforts were interrupted by the Italian invasion in 1935, not resumed until the post-war years, now from Tel Aviv. He lived just long enough to see his labors taken over by organized Jewry. His funeral in 1955 was attended by 12 Palacio children who had just arrived in Israel as part of the first contingent brought there for an education. The 1950s saw the first real effort by Jewish organizations to aid Palacios. In 1953, the Jewish Agency opened a teacher's school in Asmara near the Ethiopian coast. It began with half a dozen priests who returned to their villages after a two-month introduction to modern Judaism, and with a dozen children who stayed for a broader education. The following year, 15 young Palacios, averaging 10 years old, were brought to Israel for a three-year program in basic farming skills, Orthodox Judaism, and hygiene. They lived alongside young Israelis in an Orthodox boarding school, Kfar Batya. A total of 28 came by 1958. 18 of them returned to Ethiopia at the end of their studies. Together with the graduates of the Asmara School, they formed an educated Palacio nucleus to begin the task of bringing their people into the modern world. More than 20 schools were opened in Palacio villages. Most offered only a two-year course, but the best students graduated to a boarding school in Ambober for another 4 years, and a few went on to high school in Gondar. The new generation of Palacios grew up whose vistas were not limited to traditional lore. They learned about the outside world in school, listened to Israeli radio at night, and occasionally met Jewish tourists. Their new role models were their teachers rather than the priests and monks schooled in the old ways. They learned that their religion was not the, quote, real Judaism and began to change it. Palacios celebrated Hanukkah for the first time. They left, for example, they knew nothing of Hanukkah. They left before Judas Maccabeus rebelled against Antiochus Epiphanes, which is in the apocryphal period between the book of Malachi and the closing of the Old Testament, as the Protestants would have it, and the opening of the New Testament with the coming of Christ. Hanukkah comes from the Maccabean period. If they do not remember Purim, then that might be some inductive evidence that they were the tribe of Dan or some other tribe, because most of those who learned of Judaism from Solomon's day, if that's their lineage, should have remembered Purim, a feast added during the time of their bondage in Babylon. I don't know if they keep the Purim, but they certainly didn't keep Hanukkah. They had never known before about the post-biblical festival. They built their first sukkah for Sukkoth, tabernacle, skuth, booth, from which the word Scythian comes, really. They lit candles in their They lit candles in their synagogues. Just want to see if you're awake. Turn the cooler on again. It's getting warm now. They lit candles in their synagogues on Friday night, wore prayer shawls during the service. They switched to the Jewish calendar for their, from their own. Calendars were printed in Ethiopian languages in Israel and mailed to them. Many changes. Now, if you want to know what they were like, let me give you a little description of them. Ethiopian Colossians, they use the same Bible as the Ethiopian Christians, except they reject the New Testament portion. They also have a small literature of their own. These manuscripts in Geese were stored for centuries in Colossian synagogues and monasteries. Their synagogues resemble ordinary tukuls. Well, a tukul, you need to know what a tukul is. I guess you can live with it. Oh, yeah, here we are. Colossian villages are typical Ethiopian, clusters of tukuls on a hilltop. Tell me what tukuls are, little huts. I'll tell you what they are, since you can't find it in here. Built of sticks and branches in a circular wooden frame, sometimes plastered with mud, topped with a roof of thick grass. Rarely contain any furniture other than animal skins, hand-woven blankets, sometimes a wooden bench. Fires burn in the center of the hut. Smoke either escapes through the roof or not at all. Falasha villages differ from others by a special structure found on its edge, a hut of blood. Like Samaritans, Falashas do not touch women during menstruation or after childbirth. But unlike Samaritans, Falasha women spend their menstrual periods in separate huts. Circles of stones mark a perimeter around these tukuls beyond which men may not pass. I want to tell you, it's very hard to believe that somebody during the Middle Ages brought these Old Testament practices to these people in Ethiopia. It makes a lot more sense that their legend is true. It came straight via Menelik and his retinue when he visited his father Solomon and came back to the land of his mother, Queen of Sheba. Circles of stones mark a perimeter around these tukuls beyond which men may not pass. Additional huts are built for women to live in during their 40 or 80 days of impurity after childbirth. These are burned afterwards. Ethiopian Christians also follow the Old Testament for the most part, because both the Christians and the Falashas believe the same legend of their heritage. The Falashas say that when Ethiopia converted to Christianity, it was the great apostasy. And they are very much Old Testament-oriented Christians. The Christians of Ethiopia, by analogy, would be like the Messianic Jews, those that do not call themselves Christians, but have simply accepted Christ as the Messiah while retaining their Hebrew practices. The Ethiopian Christians follow Old Testament laws of purity, but not as strictly as the Falashas. Any Ethiopian, among other things, who performs a circumcision, has sexual intercourse, enters a room where a child was born, touches a corpse, grave, or even a dead animal, becomes unclean. Unclean Christians may not enter a church or touch holy articles after sunset. Unclean Falashas must isolate themselves completely until they can be purified by immersing their entire bodies in water. Palacios are physically indistinguishable from any other Ethiopian. Although the word Palacio means exile or stranger, the Palacios prefer to call themselves Beta Israel, House of Israel. Not even Ethiopians claim that they differ in any way other than religion. Ethiopians say the easiest way to tell a Palacio is by the smell of water coming from him because of his frequent washings for ritual purpose. Palacios become unclean every time they touch a non-Jew. Because of this, they always live apart, usually in their own villages. Where they must share a village with Christians, they build a separate neighborhood. When selling goods in a public marketplace, they carry a bowl of water to receive money in. That's no way to make friends and influence people, is it? This attitude has earned them the nickname Touch Me Nots from other Ethiopians.